the College Football Fix Podcast. With Paul Meyerberg and Dan Wolkin. This is the College Football Fix Podcast from USA Today Sports.
Welcome back to the College Football Fix Podcast presented by USA Today Sports. I'm Dan Wolkin with Paul Meyerberg. I am overwhelmed by how much we have to talk about today. It's almost like we have to do two shows to get through everything going on in the world of college football. But obviously the big story right now is Michigan. We have to start with Michigan. I was hoping we could actually start the podcast today with sort of a funny riff on what happened Saturday when Michigan played Michigan State. And for some reason, the people in East Lansing had a smiling Adolf Hitler on the scoreboard, because that is about as funny. I mean, it's awful, but it's also quite funny. I mean, I was just laughing at the absurdity of it because I have a million questions. We'll get to that maybe in a second. But the big story is Michigan coming out of that game, because going in, we had learned of this brewing scandal about not just sign stealing, but illegal scouting. And now we have some more gaps filled in. Credit to ESPN, our friends over there, reporting on Monday that Connor Stallions, this low-level analyst assistant at Michigan, a guy making $55,000 a year, has been buying tickets across the Big Ten in his own name. Just buying tickets, right? Nothing wrong there, or at least according to Michigan fans. But what seems to be happening, or what seems to have happened at Michigan, is this guy, Connor Stallions, this young, ambitious guy trying to break into the coaching business, trying to impress his bosses, buys these tickets. He sends out his friends, associates, whoever, to these games, has them film the sidelines with iPhones or whatever. They're just holding up iPhones like this the whole game. And then presumably they're taking that film, that information, and then this Connor Stallions guy is pairing that up with the regular video that they're getting. And he is then decoding the signs. And that's how they're doing it. How big of a deal do you think this is ethically from an NCAA standpoint and in terms of Michigan season? I'm curious to get your take.
I mean, ethically, it blurs the lines. But ethics is. I mean, we're not going to get in fights with people over ethics in college sports. I think we tossed out ethics a long time ago. But I think the issue, Dan, is a competitive balance. I do not believe that this rises to the extent of past scandals. I mean, I think this is a little bit more minor. It feels like a Tuesday in October scandal, but there is a competitive imbalance to me. And I'd be curious your thoughts on it. It clearly, more to me, speaks of a broader issue within Michigan's football program. When you start stacking up little things after little things like this, that's the bigger story to me than just this individual move by Connor Stallions. Whether or not, I'm sure you have an opinion on it, whether or not it came from down on high, this is not like an epic rule violation. It's cool, though, and it's inventive. Look, like, the important thing, Dan, I think we should keep in mind, and I think I want to hear your thoughts, and our readers, our listeners definitely do more than they do mine, but I think the important distinction for me is, like, if you take the cameras out of it, it's not illegal. You know what I mean? Like, people have been trying to read and steal signs for 150 years of college football. So if you take out the recording aspect of it, like, it's all fine. Like, if you just sent your friends to a game, like, hey, watch this and let me know what kind of hand signals they use, that's fine. Am I right?
I'm not sure I agree with you there, Paul. I mean, look, that might be a bit of gray, I think, the scenario you describe. Mm-hmm. But the NCAA still does prohibit in-person scouting. So to me, and I think to any sort of reasonable, unbiased person, it would also apply to people that were being sent to those games by a Michigan staff member. So, so the Michigan argument that I'm reading on Twitter and on the fan boards and all this stuff, Michigan people have convinced themselves that what happened wasn't illegal or wasn't against NCAA rules if Connor Stallions or a Michigan employee didn't do it themselves, if they weren't at the games themselves. I don't buy that, and I don't think anybody should buy that. If the only reason that you're at the, you know, the Penn State Minnesota game is because a Michigan staff member sent you there to gather information, to me that is no different than Connor Stallions going himself. That's why you're there. He's paying for you to be there, and he's expecting you to report back on information that you may be able to use to put together a game plan. Now, as far as how serious it is ethically, I think it's actually a pretty big deal. And here's why. I don't even think you have to sort of try to parse unwritten rule versus written rule on this one. Is it fair to say that if somebody was positioned in the right spot in a stadium, knowing what they're looking for, knowing what they're looking at, and what's going on the sidelines, and then that they could then take that information and it could be of some benefit in game planning? Is that true?
No, definitely is true. Definitely true. I mean, here's the thing. Like, let's step back just one small bit, just because maybe we have a good idea of how it works and maybe a listener or two does not. There is no helmet-to-helmet or helmet-to-speaker communication in college football.
Unlike the coach, the coach can't talk in a headset and the court and have the quarterback hear what he's saying. That doesn't
give the thumbs up or whatever. Like, that doesn't happen. Nor are we at the point anymore where, as we were joking about yesterday, like a guy that, you know, your number four receiver runs to the sideline, gets a play, runs it to the huddle. Right? Like, we don't even do that anymore. What happens is, like, an offensive coordinator will call a signal downstairs, seeing that person's up in the booth. And on the sideline, you will have at least two, sometimes three people. And those three people are giving, each one of those two or three people are giving a hand signal. And it's like a whole, like, third base coach calling in a bump thing, touch the bill of your hat, your stomach, your chest, whatever, down the line. One of those three is the right one, and two of those three are the wrong one. So, okay. So how it works would be, and I'm assuming this is only when it comes to trying to guess your offense, because defensive hand signals are out in the open, like defensive coordinators themselves on, as you'll often see, are doing their own thing.
And well, and a defense think, and a defense isn't really running a play. They're they're running an alignment, which.
So you have nothing to gain. Right. You have nothing to gain by doing that. So to get back to your point, Dan, there is someone who's a friend, colleague, peer of Connor Stallions, who's watching the offense and then videotaping these three guys and then trying to match it up with the play and trying to find out which of those three guys is calling in the right thing. It's a little bit of a Rosetta Stone situation going in. But to get back to what you're saying, absolutely. If you go through those steps, I'm not questioning the ethics of it. I'm just questioning whether, like, as a joke, whether we care about ethics in college sports. But ethically, it is absolutely wrong. And not just that, it's a violation, a clear violation. When you start recording and trying to match it up, that's a clear violation of NCAA rules, right?
Yeah, and I don't even necessarily want to put it all on NCAA rules, because that's a whole separate thing that, like, people are going to litigate from here till the end of time about everything that goes on with the NCAA and its enforcement staff, right? Let's just put that aside and just say, is this right or wrong in terms of the sportsmanship, the bounds by which people are sort of operating here? I mean, to me, this is a pretty bad violation of that. Now, do I think the sign stealing is why Michigan is good or has been good, or why they beat Ohio State, or why they got to the playoff? No, not really. No. What is the actual impact? Like, how many points did they save, or were they able to prevent over the course of a season because they had this extra information? Impossible to say. Like, there's no way to actually or fairly characterize that. But I can tell you, like, this is just one of those things. You kind of go through the coaching fraternity and what they believe is okay, and nobody thinks this is okay. And it's not like another thing Michigan people have put out over the last 24 hours is, well, 2 years ago, the NCAA competition committee said they should get rid of this rule and allow in-person scouting, right? Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter that the competition committee said there's not much benefit from it. If it's against the rule and you broke the rule, then you've gained a competitive advantage. And people are pissed. People are pissed in the Big Ten, and they have a right to be. And I wouldn't be surprised if the next step of this coming out in the subsequent days is that it was more than just Big Ten teams. That maybe he was doing this for potential playoff opponents, let's just say.
He should have done more.
Certainly should have done more for TCU because that was about as badly coached a game as you could have. The weird thing is, I just don't know like what this is going to mean for the Michigan season. This is unfolding in real time as they're sitting here 8-0. NCAA infractions cases take months to play out.
Right.
I would be surprised if the Big Ten came in and said, we have all this information. You're not eligible anymore for our Big Ten championship. I don't even know how that would happen.
Right.
And if it did, and if somebody did do that, Michigan is almost certainly going to go to court, get an injunction, and play the game. Like that's so then it gets really messy there. Is Michigan going to say, yeah, you caught us? We're falling on our sword because we're so embarrassed. That's not going to happen. So I guess like the most likely outcome is we're going to be sitting there January, 10th or whatever day the national championship game is, and Michigan is in the college football playoff championship game against Georgia or whoever. Mm-hmm. And the big story is, how tainted is this title?
Mm-hmm.
Congratulations.
You know, it's funny, Dan, we're like 4 or 5 weeks away from saying to each other, this whole Harbaugh 3-game suspension thing, the next time we talk about that will be at the playoff, about like the season that Michigan has had. I hate to think that this will be something that we just talk about in the playoff, but I kind of feel like you're right. Like this season is going to keep marching along. And at some point we will try to put this into perspective, but there's nothing that's going to, this is not something that's going to derail the season for Michigan. Like, even in a joking way, like I just can't see how this stops them. I mean, other than on the field, they could lose, but it's not going to be an off the field situation where they're going to get yanked from the Big Ten championship game. I just feel like that's ridiculous. But, you know, you made an interesting point that this is not stuff that I think within the fraternity of coaching, he's going to get a lot of support for. You're not hearing a lot of, well, everyone else does it too.
No.
People,
I don't think people are doing this actually.
It requires a level of, I mean, this is not like MI5 level espionage, obviously, by Connor Stallions, but it does require a bit of like planning.
Yeah.
And like forwardness in terms of my how I'm going to do this. Yes, we are actively going to search this out. And, you know, it is telling that like very clearly that other Big Ten programs and very likely other Big Ten coaches are the ones who brought this to the leagues and to the NCAA's attention.
Well,
and I think that's very telling.
Yeah. And, you know, I think what happened is, okay, word started to get around. Something's going on in Michigan. School started to notice they've got our calls to an unusual degree, to a degree you don't normally see. And then people start to go back and look at, all right, what's going on here? And then people start to point at this guy, Connor Stallions, who, by the way, like if you look at pictures, he's on the sideline right next to the offensive coordinator when they have the ball. He's on the sideline right next to the defensive coordinator. And he's got these sheets, right? So he's integral in talking to both sides of the ball, what they're doing during the game. And so then people start to look into it. And, I mean, it's funny. Like, the reason that people were able to connect it to him is because he was buying tickets to these games on his own credit card.
Mm-hmm.
And the credit card data, you know, is out there in the cloud somewhere, and they can find it. And you know, so who was he sending?
Who was reimbursing?
Who was paying for it? Like, it's just a, there's just a whole lot of unanswered questions still, but it's quite a story, and it's going to be, it's in some ways going to be kind of the dominant story as we come down the stretch, because I was talking to somebody the other day who was at the Michigan State game, agent, and they're, you know, Michigan's the best team. Like, there's sort of now this consensus, this broad consensus, like they're incredibly good.
Yep.
So I guess that's where we are. All right. Do you have one more point before we move on?
I don't know. I mean, we're going to talk about this every single week. I just feel like it's Tuesday the 24th. We're going to talk in on Halloween. And just by the time we get to Halloween, I think we'll have more here. But just on the face, like, be prepared for this to be, as you said at the top, like, be prepared for this to be a weekly thing.
Another thing we've kind of gotten to talking about every week is USC and the problems at USC, the problems with Lincoln Riley. They lose to Utah. They could have won the game. They took the lead late, and then Utah drove down the field, aided in part by a penalty, a roughing the passer penalty.
Yeah, poor guy.
Yeah, so that was a tough one. But also, I think it was fairly predictable that Utah was going to score in that situation. After the game, Lincoln Riley doesn't make any players available to the media. He's the only one talking. This is kind of an issue on its own. Not an issue for me in terms of the media part, which I know people don't really care about. But in some ways, I think this is the most telling thing that's happened at USC over the last couple years, because I sort of now finally have a picture of what the deal is here. They're coddled. They're babied. And the reason they're that way is because Lincoln Riley, a 40-year-old guy who became a head coach at, what, 32 years old?
33, 34, yeah.
Because he is also a bit of a baby and sensitive to criticism. And his instinct in a tough moment is not accountability, tough love, face the music. It's shield the players. It's protect the players. That's his default setting as a coach and as a human being.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is when you watch them play, it all starts to fit together. They don't really have physical practices because he's afraid of getting people hurt and he wants to protect the players. And so what happens? They go out in the games and they're not physical. And they get pounded by teams like Utah that do play physical football and do practice that way. And they have a moment like they had Saturday night and they're not accountable. And they don't play that way. They don't play with accountability for each other. They kind of play as if they know that there's no consequence for messing up.
Mm-hmm.
And so they never fix their defense and they're always out of position. I guess my point is, to me, it all fits together in the problems with Lincoln Riley. At Oklahoma, he took over a program and they were very successful at Oklahoma, much more successful so far than they've been at USC, but he took over a program that had a structure in place. It had a staff in place, which he largely kept intact. He had the best athletic director in the country, and Joe Castiglione has been there a long time, who understands, you know, can guide. Well, at USC, he goes out and has complete control of everything, and it looks like crap. I got some flack on Twitter. I sort of halfway jokingly said this was the first, like, big time program that was 100% turned over to a millennial, and it starts to look like a millennial production. I stand by that in the sense that, look, I mean, I'm not that much older than a millennial, like a year or two. We are soft a little bit, you know, and we're not old school. We have different sort of values. We have different sort of views about life. And I think, like, USC right now is sort of the avatar for the millennial way of doing things. And it's getting its ass kicked by old school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what I don't know if you're going to finish on that, but that was the point I was going to make. It's like Utah and USC are so profoundly different programs. The players they recruit, the players they develop, the sort of people they recruit, the way that Whittingham runs his program compared to where Riley, runs his program. And you hate to like default to, well, toughness is going to win out, but this is football, you know, like toughness is going to win out eventually. So you watch Utah play USC and it's almost a foregone conclusion that when you got down to it and there were minutes left that Utah was going to find a way to win, just like USC was going to find a way to lose. So we saw this coming after Notre Dame. They're now 6-2. We can officially stop talking about SC. But these are issues like that you mentioned that are not fixable overnight. Like if the issue is the way that they are run as a program, then that's going to take Lincoln Riley, like changing who he is as a coach, as a person, his voice. And that seems like, A, he has no real impetus to do it, and B, if he does it, it's going to be a process. So feels like a lost season, Dan, for SC. I mean, officially, even at 6-0, we thought that it was ticking, but this season is over for them. That's they're not the most disappointing team in the country, but they're in the conversation.
But I do think it's been a massive disappointment overall as just an experiment of Lincoln Riley at USC. And we don't often talk about that in year two, that something has failed. But and the record's good, like compared to what most teams aspire to. But I think at USC they hired him for something more than 9-3, than 8-4. And he had in his hip pocket the best quarterback in the country. And what did they do with it? And how did they use the portal? And how did he build his defense? It's all gone wrong. And it's interesting when you look at how it's going at USC in year two. I'm sorry, in year two versus some other coaches who were first-time head coaches, defensive coordinators, getting that opportunity to be a head coach for the first time. And it's actually going quite well. I mean, you look at Brent Venables, who obviously replaced him at Oklahoma. You look at Dan Lanning at Oregon, Marcus Freeman, Mike Elko at Duke. Like, these teams have pretty quickly become tough to play against. USC's not defensive coordinator.
Right, defensive coordinator.
USC's not tough to play against. Mm-hmm. They're talented. They're just not tough to play against. And I think that maybe in this craze of, oh, just go hire the hotshot offensive genius whiz kid, that sort of got lost. Is being tough to play against is actually a very good thing for a football team to be.
Yeah, the guys that you mentioned, like specifically Elko, like I think it would be easy for a school that's in Duke's position to look out at the landscape when hiring a coach and say, hey, let's get this guy who can coordinate an offense that had 528 yards a game at North Texas. I mean, whatever. I think that definitely was the case in college football for well over a decade, that you would see offensive trendiness and you would immediately watch in the next year or two guys from that tree become the next wave of head coaches. But the pendulum shift seems to be going back towards defense because of what you mentioned. These are, and not necessarily, these aren't 65-year-old grizzled Joe Lee Duns. These are like 37-year-old Marcus Freeman, 40-something Elko, 30-something Dan Lanning. So that's really interesting to me, Dan, and something to look at in the coaching cycle this December, January, is whether that's a trend, because the results from the 2022 class are starting to speak for themselves.
Okay, let's talk about a couple other programs here that are not having great weeks. Clemson, 4-3. It's over, right? In terms of them being a national contender. I mean, obviously not for this year. This year, They're done. But I mean, in the future, what do they have to do? Is Dabo just going to like double, triple, quadruple down? Is he going to start over? Is he going to walk away? This is the most interesting moment for Clemson football since like 2015, when they kind of started this rise.
Yeah, I would say like since 2010 or 2009, when they started winning double digits. It's weird, right? Like you watch Clemson play this year and they feel like a program that is on the other end of the spectrum. Like, they feel like to me the 09-10 teams that like played well, but still lost close games, still like stubbed their toe and like hadn't learned how to get to that point yet, which they did, I think, after beating Ohio State in 13 or 14 is kind of their breaking out point. This is like a good team that does the metrics well. Like, their offense is not terrible. They play defense pretty well, but they're managing to lose games they should win. And that's the really worrisome thing for me, is if they've lost that mojo, then how do you get it back? You know? So, yeah, I don't know what the future holds for Clemson. I just know that this year is cooked. They're not going to play an ACC championship game. I don't even know if they're a top 25 team going into next season. I guess it depends how they finish, but it's another lost season for them in terms of a national championship, obviously.
Yeah, and Garrett Riley has made no difference. It looks the exact same offensively. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about how the numbers look good offensively and defensively for them, I mean, isn't the separator there that they just don't have a game-breaking skill talent that can be a one or two plays in a game is just going to result in points? Like, they just don't have that.
No, now, they still do not.
Yeah, and they still should have won that Miami game. They had the lead. They let it slip away. In overtime, Cade Klubnik is running on fourth down when he's supposed to hand off. That was right. Weird. I mean, Dabo looked like he wanted to kill somebody. I thought he was mad at Garrett Riley. I think he was mad at the quarterback. I just think they're just another ACC team now. That's kind of what they are. And it's hard for me to imagine how that happened when you come off two championships, you put all the money into the facilities, to the coaching contracts, to the whatever. How do you not capitalize? How do you not – we now can go coast to coast and get some offensive linemen.
Mm-hmm.
It's bizarre. Sometimes, like, you can just look at the decline of a program and easily diagnose what happened or why it went bad. In this case, I don't really know how to diagnose it other than just you have a head coach in Dabo Swinney who's extremely stubborn and the same extreme belief in what they're doing that maybe got them to the top is not mm-hmm. serving them well on the way down.
Definitely not, but I don't think it's out of like left field to say this is a talent issue. It's a talent issue. You know, they don't have – they're just not as good. And I know that sounds stupid because it is simplistic, but they're just not as good. They're not as talented from quarterback across the board. They're just not as good. And when you watch them play, like, I watch them play and I expect them to win games, like on Saturday. Like, I expected them to seal the deal against Miami, partially because Miami in a close game in the fourth quarter, like, that's not their wheelhouse. But they're just missing something. They don't have a spark. They don't have game-changing players. And that's it. That's how you get to 4-3. You don't have the players.
I think in the same boat as Clemson, but different in terms of, all right, where do you go from here, is Penn State. They lose to Ohio State 20-12. It's just more of the same from James Franklin, who was 1-9 against the Buckeyes. And this is just kind of where Penn State is. They are going to win 9 or 10 games every single year, just kind of by being better than everybody on their schedule. And then it's all going to come down to playing Michigan and Ohio State. And in the years Michigan has stunk, Penn State's managed to beat them. And then they really have not been able to beat Ohio State at any point, except for the 1 year, which now kind of looks like an outlier. James Franklin is a really good coach, runs a really good program. He's been there a decade. Is there any hope, though, that James Franklin is going to be the guy to get you over the top? And if he's not, the next guy is not guaranteed to be as good as James Franklin. I think it's a very difficult conundrum for both Franklin and Penn State at this point in their relationship, because it's not that the expectations are unrealistic or unreasonable. To me, it's just, you kind of just get tired of doing the same thing after a decade, every single year. It takes all the romance and possibility out of what makes people fanatical about this sport to begin with.
Yeah, and they're treading water as a program. That's a dangerous place to be for Penn State, because you can only, like, And the clock has run out, but you can only live on the very good, we're really good, we're going to get there clock for so long. And that those days are done. I mean, they haven't achieved it, and those days are done. But I've given this a lot of thought the last couple of days. My feelings on this, I don't think this is what I would do. If I was Penn State, I'd want to keep James Franklin for as long as possible and just hope that one of these years, just they kind of luck into it. They just kind of luck into it. You know, just kind of like get lucky, get hot, and just win a national championship. Because it's 10 years now. So they're not going to be a better program than Ohio State. Okay, so we can say that. Like, they're never going to be the better program than Ohio State. We've had 10 years. It's time to say, no, that's not going to happen.
Right.
Like you said, when they beat Michigan, it's because Michigan has entered into the odd hellscape season that they have every 8 or 7 years, whatever. So you're not a better program than Michigan either. So, yes, you could, like, get rid of James Franklin. Good luck. But you could, and then pay the next guy and hope that it works out. But no, I would just stick with Franklin. Like, you're going to go 10-2 more often than not. Maybe you get lucky every once in a while. Maybe the 12-team playoff, you play important games. I would just stick with what you got. I know that sucks to hear, but there's no solution. What are you going to do? You're going to hire some guy and just think that he'll do better than Franklin? Nah. Just roll with it. This is life, though. You're going to lose to Michigan, too. But you guys saw that. Even you lied to yourself back in August, but everyone did that.
So as the season goes along, it's really amazing. The first half of it has kind of all been about, all right, who's actually good? Is parity here? But as always, the season kind of churns along and the water finds its level, right?
Right.
So you look up now as we get to the end of October, and it's Michigan, it's Ohio State, it's Georgia, it's Alabama. Now, look, it's still some other teams, but Oklahoma barely hangs on to beat UCF. Might have been a hangover game.
Maybe.
It probably was. But it does indicate some underlying weakness there when you're struggling that much against a team who's not very good. UCF's not very good. Texas barely holds on against Houston, frankly, with the benefit of a bad spot on third down. Now, they did stop a fourth down play, but not a very impressive performance by Texas. And now Quinn Ewers is out with an AC joint issue, which who knows how that's going to affect them going forward. They may be starting to regress to the mean. North Carolina gets beat by Virginia. We loved them up last week, and they suffer, I mean, probably the worst loss of the year by a contender. And Washington, I didn't stay up to watch them play Arizona State. I just couldn't bring myself to do 3 in the morning. 15-7 over Arizona State at home after they had played an amazing game against Oregon. Now, again, hangover possibly. But when you're holding on for dear life against a 1-6 Arizona State team, just like with Oklahoma, UCF, there's probably some underlying weakness there.
Yeah.
So where are we at? I mean, as we get into November, December, are we just going to kind of be talking about the same things we always talk about? Alabama, Georgia, Michigan, Ohio State.
Yeah.
And then maybe one of those Pac-12 teams gets in there.
Yeah, maybe Florida State gets in there, something like that. But look, I think one thing I could say, and this is actually being kind to Georgia because they actually haven't looked like this. I think there are three really great teams. There's Michigan, there's Georgia, then there's Ohio State. And then everyone else is kind of eh. You know, just kind of eh. I mean, they're good. But those are the three. I put those three above the rest, Dan. So, yes, Alabama's lurking, and it's just a matter of time before we're all talking about the final Saturday of November and then the possibility of Bama, Georgia for the SEC championship. So it feels familiar. What year is this? It could be last year, the year before. So, yeah, I mean, it's been a little bit of a boring season when it comes to deciding the college football playoff, for example, which we're one week out from doing.
Yeah, and look, I've been impressed with Washington all along. But the question we had asked here is, were they more like 2019 LSU or were they more like 2022 Tennessee? That performance against Arizona State suggests maybe a little bit more like Tennessee, and that they're going to run into somebody who just kind of stops them cold, that offense, and it's going to be lights out. You know, maybe that's, you know, maybe that's, I don't, it's probably not going to be USC. Maybe it's probably going to be Utah.
Right.
You know, Utah does that to people. So, yeah, Florida State, look, I think they're really good. They have a lot of different ways they can beat you. That's why I like that team. They can win different ways, and I think that's a hugely valuable skill. I'm still not 100% sold on their defense being good enough, although it's better than maybe than what it looked like against Duke, because you know they gave Duke a short field. There was a pick six. Like, they actually played pretty well defensively against Duke, but but Riley Leonard was compromised toward the end of the game. He was hurt. I guess what I'm saying is I do think Florida State belongs close to that top group, and I think they could absolutely beat an Alabama for sure. But yeah, they could. I could also envision them having a really bad day somewhere too.
Yeah, and likewise, I think with Georgia, like, they're going to play Florida on Saturday. I expect them to win, but this is another team that has been playing with fire to a degree. Like, I mean, Ohio State too. So if you really want to get down to it, only the team that knows your plays is dominating, and that's Michigan. Everyone else is a little bit gettable. But, you know, we did talk about this as a team yesterday about how this has been, like I mentioned, like a really boring, at the top, a boring season. Boring and predictable. I think Alabama losing to Texas was the one result that is outside the norm. But other than that, I think it's kind of held true to form, or at least true to recent history, you know? So there will be shakeups in November, but chaos has not happened yet to college football. I mean, it will, just not yet.
And the thing about Alabama in the mix of all this is you could easily see them getting to the playoff, but I'm having a hard time envisioning them winning a title, because I just, man, it's interesting to watch them play. It's really interesting to me, because there just doesn't seem to be much there. When you see them on the field and what they can and can't do, it just looks very limited. But I will give them credit for fighting. That's a fighting bunch. And they flipped that game against Tennessee in the second half impressively because they were willing to go take the game. And, you know, but at the same time, like the last couple weeks, they barely hang on to beat Arkansas. They barely beat A&M. They have LSU in a couple weeks. LSU's capable of beating them, but it's in Tuscaloosa.
Right.
You know, Alabama has to win out. They're not getting into the playoff with two losses. They have to beat Georgia. I'm not sure I want to see Alabama in the playoff, because to me, Alabama feels like this Alabama team being in the playoff would sort of feel like, you know, like Cincinnati a couple years ago.
Oof.
where they're there and you're like, it's cool they're there, but they're not seriously going to win anything. So if you took the name off the jersey, I think that's how we'd be viewing this team. But I give them all the credit for being where they are. I just don't know what it means.
Yeah, I'm with you in that I want to give them a lot of credit for getting back to this point. And not just because, oh my God, Alabama's 7-1. Like, wow. I mean, of course they're 7-1. But I think the way that they've done it on the heels of Texas has been really impressive. They're a 12-round boxer right now. They're not delivering knockout blows. They're winning on the card every single week. But I think one thing about Tennessee that was impressive to me, and we mentioned it last week, was Alabama doesn't really know how to put teams away, but they were in a position with Tennessee where they had to crawl out of it. Like, it wasn't like Arkansas where they were up 24-6. They had to come back out of that. So that just tells you, I think, a bit about the mental fortitude of this group. They're limited, right? So if they did get into a January setting against an Ohio State or Michigan or Georgia in December, I think those flaws will become more obvious. But I like the method that they're using to win, and I think that method is repeatable against whomever they play, but you got to admit that this is still a flawed group. So part of me does not think they'll even get to Georgia with one loss, but if they do, obviously that's a playoff berth on the line.
So who are they going to lose to? LSU? I mean, LSU's pretty explosive.
Yeah, LSU's got the offense, right? But LSU's defense also bottom tier in the entire country. So LSU seems like the team that would beat them. I don't think it's going to be Auburn, but that's the game that would be the most worrisome for me, is that you get in a shootout with LSU and Jalen Milroe turns the ball over twice.
Yeah, and the thing with Georgia, they were off last week. You know, just talking to people around that program, not that they're down or they're feeling bad about the situation, but they kind of have the sense over there that when it rains, it pours. They're just not the same team they're not the team they expected to be because of just how many injuries have hit them, right? So, yeah, they're going to go out there and fight and play, and they've still got more than enough to beat pretty much everybody on their schedule. But sometimes you just get that sense it's a star-crossed year. It's not going your way. It's not going to happen. It's a real challenge, I think, not necessarily to get them up for Kirby Smart, to get that team emotionally ready to play, because I think that's what he does. He's really good at that, and they're going to be fine. It's just at some point there is a threshold where you can't lose that many people. So I don't know, like, could this be the year the SEC doesn't get in? I mean, it's not likely, but it's on the table because you've got two really good teams in the Big Ten. We'll see if Oklahoma can keep doing what they're doing. Florida State has got a couple more challenges left, but they're clearly the best team in the ACC. And there's definitely going to be a Pac-12 team in. So yeah, Somebody's going to get left out.
Yeah, 11-1 Ohio State against 11-2 Alabama, winners against Georgia in the SEC championship game. Ohio State loses to Michigan by a point. We could get there. I mean, it's like ridiculous to say the SEC won't get in, but I feel like the outline that you just mentioned, like, you're not going to keep out an unbeaten Power 5 team.
Yeah.
Not in the playoff, not in the 14 playoff, and obviously not in the 12 team.
Well, unfortunately, we don't have a ton of great matchups to talk about this coming weekend. It's a bit of a dud slate. The big one, Oregon at Utah. Oregon is a 6.5-point road favorite. It's a Fox 3:30 p.m. game. Utah coming off the emotional win over SC. This is gonna be a good one. It's gonna be physical. It's gonna be fun to watch. If you like guys hitting each other, this is a game for you.
Yeah, I think this is a good game, and I think it's a game that Oregon will win because, unlike SC, I think they're going to stand up better.
Yeah.
So I like Oregon to win this one, and I really still believe that Oregon's one of the best teams in the country. So I really want them to get back and play Washington 11-1, 12-0. I think that would be outstanding for the Pac-12. One last game. But yeah, 6.5 at Utah. I mean, that's a lot at Utah, but I think it fits. I think this is a 7-10-point win for the Ducks.
There is a ranked versus ranked Duke Louisville matchup on ESPN at 3:30.
Yeah. Enjoy.
Yeah, have at it.
I'm not gonna be watching that one. I mean, yeah, I'll be watching. That's my commercial game. But I mean, Oregon Utah is the one to watch. Come on.
It's Florida Georgia week. Georgia's a 14.5-point favorite. I don't know. Florida's 5-2. They came back a couple weeks ago in that miraculous fourth quarter over South Carolina when they were down 10 and South Carolina couldn't close the deal. I guess Florida is capable, I guess, if all the stars align. But I'm having trouble seeing it.
Florida plays four top 15 teams the rest of the way. Arkansas is the one exception. If they can get this one, it changes the trajectory of everything. But if they don't, I'm just sitting there like, damn, they could go 7-5. I mean, at best, that wouldn't be great. But we did write them off a couple weeks ago after Kentucky. They played okay. But I can't imagine they beat Georgia. I just can't. I can't picture it, even banged up Georgia.
Hey, by the way, since you mentioned Arkansas, Dan Enos got fired, offensive coordinator. He coached 8 games at Arkansas. Arkansas will pay $3.7 million for 8 games of work.
Man.
Dan Enos, the finesse king.
I don't want to argue for someone losing their job, but isn't this the responsibility of the head coach to make, like, he hires his assistant coaches, right? shouldn't Sam Pittman have to respond to some direct questioning about why he hired this dude and why that they have to pay $3 million for him not to coach there anymore? I feel like that's an important question.
Sam Pittman was a fun story for like 5 minutes in 2021, but I think it's fair to say there's a reason why somebody who was an offensive line coach their entire career, getting a head coaching job for the first time in the SEC at age, what was he, 60?
Yeah, close to 60.
60-ish when he got the job. That was not a great idea. And also probably illustrates why he was Arkansas's 47th choice when he got hired.
Right.
Somewhere around there. I may be exaggerating a little bit, but if you remember, that was the year like a ton of jobs came open. Mm-hmm. And Arkansas was really struggling with that search. They did actually interview Deion,
right,
in that search and went a different direction. Ended up with Pittman. He was kind of the guy who knew the program, the guy who was comfortable with the boosters. I mean, it was like either going to be Sam Pittman or Barry Lunney Jr. Like that was the pick, right? So it was a little bit of a bleak situation. Now the problem is, they gave him a new contract. They gave him a new contract after that 2021 season.
Right.
Actually, let me back up. Here's what happens. They have a great year in 2021, Arkansas. Sam Pittman, at the end of that year, hires Jimmy Sexton to be his agent, dumps his old agent, and hires Jimmy Sexton to be his agent.
Nice.
Gets an extension that guarantees an extra year every time he wins 7 games. They weren't very good last year, but they managed to get to 7-6.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets that extra year. So his buyout's like $16 million, unless his record falls under 500 from the start of 2021 to the time he's fired. So Arkansas has got like a couple more games. Let's just say they lose. Doesn't matter who they're against, but they're SEC games. That will put him exactly at 500 going into the second to last game of the year. The second to last game of the year, Arkansas plays Florida International. The Florida International game will determine whether Arkansas pays $16 million or $10 million in a buyout. Wow. How about that?
So he is 21 and 23 right now, right?
But it doesn't. The 2020 season doesn't count in this calculation.
Oh, did you say
it's,
that?
It's from the start of the 2021 right. season on.
Let's do this math here. 9, 16, 18. He's 18 and 16 right now.
Right.
Okay. Okay, 18 and 16. Let's do this. Okay, 18 and 16. We got Florida on the 4th, 18 and 17. Auburn, 19. Yeah, it's you know which one it is. It's Auburn because they're going to beat FIU. I think it's the Auburn game at home. That's the one that's going to keep him. Well, he has to be below 500.
Yeah, so below. So even if he beats, all he has to do is beat Florida International to get that extra $6 million.
Nice.
Isn't that amazing?
America, what a country. Wow, what a place. That's crazy. Oh, man. Beat FIU, gets $6 million.
I think if you're Arkansas, by the way, you have to make the move this year because there's not going to be probably that many comparable jobs open. I think if you look at the SEC in particular, you're probably looking at A&M in Arkansas, and that's about it. And so if you're Arkansas, I think you'd rather be in that market than in whatever market may take place next year, where just the natural order of things probably going to be more SEC openings. And then you're back in the same situation you were when you hired him, which is competing with Ole Miss and competing, you know. So I think they kind of have to do it. And Sam Pittman, wonderful guy. Congratulations on the retirement package. He's about to win, but just not
on the Lake House.
Not a capable head coach at this level.
Yeah, you watch this team play, and you recognize that there are warning signs that suggest this is not like hire a new coordinator fix. These are deeper.
All right, let's go back to this week. BYU at Texas. Are you excited to see Malik Murphy play football?
Yeah, I mean, I think they can win this game with him. That's not a question about it. But I'm more interested in seeing what the offense looks like without yours. I mean, it could be weeks, Dan. Like, we just don't know. It could be weeks. So something to keep an eye out. We're heading towards the end of October, and they don't have their QB. That's concerning.
Ohio State of Wisconsin. That's going to be an ugly one. That's going to be hard to watch.
I think so too. Wisconsin, they won against Illinois yesterday. That game, the less said about that, the better. 25-21. I don't think they match up well with Ohio State. This feels like, you know, Buckeyes offense could awaken.
Tennessee, Kentucky, Colorado at UCLA. I'm sure that'll get good ratings. It's the ABC game.
Nice 7:30. Yes, yeah, we haven't talked about Deion yet. I expect them to lose.
They will lose.
I expect them to lose. 17-point underdog, by the way. That's a lot.
UCLA's defense is very good.
So good. So good. So, yeah, that's going to be loss number four for the Bruins, or for the Buffaloes.
Other than that, man, Oklahoma-Kansas. Oklahoma at Kansas, the noon game. That's a good one.
That's a good one. Yeah, I like to
not great.
Kansas put up some points. But, look, Oklahoma's beatable. Like you mentioned, what's this UCF? I mean, SMU, Cincinnati, they've had games this year where they have not – looked the part of a top six team in the country. So, okay, you can put some points on them. It could be interesting. Let's see.
I think Oklahoma is playing above their head this season, just in general. And that's, I mean, that as a compliment to Brent Venables and what they're doing. I think they're maximizing what they are. And that's all you can ask. I just think they have some holes. So it is what it is. Florida State at Wake Forest. Boy, this is it's tough to make this all sound exciting.
Well, in good news, Michigan State is guaranteed to have as many points as Hitler references this week. Last week, Hitler won out 1-0, but that's only because they're on the road. I don't expect there to be any Hitler trivia on the big screen at Minnesota. But Michigan State's year continues to get worse. Like we've said a bunch of times, it can't get worse. It continues to get worse.
It always gets worse.
It's going to be – I'm excited for what November can hold. There's a lot of potential there.
If you're Michigan State, do you look at hiring Jim Knowles? We talked about the defensive coordinator thing, right? The tide was sort of turning toward defensive coordinators. Look at what Jim Knowles has done with that Ohio State defense. I mean, that defense used to be a joke. 2 years ago, that defense was a joke. And they're very good now.
Yeah,
and actually, you got to give credit to Ryan Day, though, for doing what Lincoln Riley should have done.
Right, which is give the defense over to a proven coordinator and get out of the way. I mean, it's about who you've worked for. I mean, if it is about who you've worked for, I think Knowles working for Gundy and Ryan Day is preparative. So that'd be interesting. You don't really hear his name in connection with those jobs, which is fine. Some guys are just great defensive coordinators, but certainly he's put his name on the map on a national level with the way they've played. The turnaround in 12 months has been like, they're damn good. I mean, statistically, they're best in the country right now.
All right, I think that's where we'll wrap it for this week. We actually got through it in less time than I thought. So we did a good job.
Nice job, Dan.
Self-editing is always good, especially for me. Okay. That's been the College Football Fix for this week. Thanks to Eric Smith, our sports editor, or college sports editor / podcast producer, Paul Meyerberg, Dan Wolken, USA Today Sports. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
The College Football Fix Podcast. With Paul Meyerberg and Dan Wolken. This is the College Football Fix Podcast from USA Today Sports.